Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Did you know that you could support the Organic Gardener Podcast without doing anything differently? If you're going to buy something on Amazon.com, since I'm an Amazon affiliate, if you go to Amazon through a link on my page, which every book that is listed on my website is linked to Amazon.com, you don't have to buy that book, but anything you buy that day from Amazon will give me a very, very small commission, but I got to tell you, it would sure help pay for, you know, just some of the basics it costs to keep the podcast up there. So if you like what you hear and you did want to give me just a little bit of support, that would be a great way for you to do it. If you're already going to Amazon to purchase something, like I said, all the books are linked up to because I am an Amazon affiliate. And so just if you didn't know anything, you don't have to buy that specific book, but just if you go to Amazon through my website, they do still give me a commission. So thanks for your support. Welcome to episode 160 of the Organic Gardener Podcast. Today, I am super excited because I have a guest who was on. He was episode 70, so almost 100 episodes ago. And he just dropped golden seed after golden seed after golden seed. So I know listeners are going to be excited to hear from David Wolverton from Arley, Montana. So welcome back to the Organic Gardener Podcast, David.
A pleasure.
Well, we're just excited to have you here. Last time we talked about a lot of different things. I had met you at the Missoula Farmers Market. And I was really interested in your tomatoes. And you talked to us about grafting and growing them in hot areas, and we talked about growing a farmer's market too, and some very successful secrets one of the things I really like that you talked about was like when you decided to go back to the farmer's market, you had taken a little break to take care of your parents, and when you went back, the first thing you did was you went and asked what does the market need. And one of the answers you got was, yes, we need tomatoes, and I need you to do something about the price of the tomatoes. So I think that's just a great tip for listeners to don't say, oh, I want to sell mushrooms, or I want to sell, you know, peppers or zucchinis or whatever. Like, go to your market and see what does your market need. Like, that was just great advice. And then the other thing was that you talked about, like, I met you because some woman that was selling there was like, well, I got my tomato plants from David, and that's how I found you. And you were starting them in December, and so I reached out to you and said, hey, it's December, what are you doing? And so that was kind of why how we got to our conversation today. And so from here on, I'm going to be quiet, and you just tell us, what are you up to? Well, tell people a little bit about yourself maybe first to kind of introduce yourself again if somebody wasn't listening back last year.
Okay, well, I'm retired. I was, as you mentioned, took care of my parents, and that pulled me out of the workforce, but then I was still able to manage, but it was just what would be nice to do, what would be something that would be a nice contribution to the community as well as keep me entertained. And the farmer's market had been something I'd been doing for a couple decades, and after my parents were gone, then I went ahead and went back to that. And as you mentioned, December tomatoes, well, guess what I'm doing? I was just getting things organized. Today I start tomatoes again for this upcoming season. That sounds awfully early, but I grow for my own greenhouse, plus I now graft for other people who raise tomatoes in greenhouses. I need to add immediately, these are not hydroponic. I do not do hydroponic plants or greenhouses, neither do these other people. We grow in dirt, real honest to goodness dirt. And we think that's key to having a much better flavored tomato. Hydroponics do have their place, and in the winter, nothing better than a nice hydroponically grown tomato. But when the season permits, it's best to have them growing in the more natural way with the soil. So that's what I do. The grafting, as well as the hoop houses we use, allows for a much more expanded season. Our target this year is to have tomatoes at the market in May. I didn't pull it off last year, but my one grower, he did. He actually had fresh, ripe tomatoes in the month of May for the farmer's market.
Nice. Okay, so do you want to tell us a little bit about, so are you grafting these or are you growing them from seeds or are you doing some of both? Last time I had never heard of grafting before and then you kind of told us about that. Maybe you want to explain to listeners what that is if they haven't heard of it either.
Certainly, the grafting of vegetables is actually a takeoff from something that people have done for thousands of years. Even in, for example, the Bible mentions grafting olive trees. Well, in the Mediterranean basin, they were grafting olives and other fruit trees way back 2,000 years and earlier, so that it's really an old practice, except that when it came to annual vegetables, nobody really saw the merit. I mean, after all, they live 1 year. Well, in the 1920s, the Japanese started experimenting with grafting tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, and melons and cucumbers. Their soils are heavily used. It's a very highly populated country with very limited agricultural land. The buildup of diseases was problematic. They also needed to maximize production. So these very ingenious people in Japan in the 1920s started developing the grafting of vegetables that we know today, that I now employ. In fact, in Europe and Asia, the majority of tomatoes, eggplants, and so forth are grafted. In the United States, it's much more of a novel concept. We have more space. We have more land in which we can rotate the crops. We can move around so that the soil disease buildup isn't as problematic as it would be in a more crowded country. But nevertheless, there are advantages. And one of the advantages is that the grafted tomato vine lasts much longer. So in hydroponic greenhouses, they do use grafted plants. Now, that doesn't make sense initially because in a greenhouse, they can keep conditions perfect, perfect temperature, the nutrients and everything. But they still use grafts because it enhances the longevity of the vine. So they get a lot more production and they don't have to replace on such a rapid cycle as they would normally. For those of us who just grow seasonally, it's the advantage is that a grafted tomato plant has better cold resistance. They're not frost-proof. You still have to protect from frost. But cooler soils aren't nearly the problem with a grafted tomato plant. Also, the productivity is higher. The vines do last longer. And the overall benefit is so tremendous that those for whom I've grown the grafted plants, they don't want to grow ungrafted plants now. They really do prefer the grafted, as I have discovered. I should emphasize the grafting is not exotic or strange. You do grow two sets of seedlings. One is the rootstock, and the rootstock is a special variety. It's a hybrid of the standard tomato plant with some exotic tomato relative from South America. And it has a much greater vigor, much more greater resistance to the soil microbes that might otherwise infect and kill the plant. And then one uses regular tomatoes for the top part. Just whether you like big beef or you like one of the heirlooms, then you can slice it, put it on top of this rootstock. And when it joins, then you have a sort of a Frankenstein tomato. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it's a pretty vigorous plant that conveys the best of both worlds. The rootstocks don't produce fruit that's worth anything. It's, like I say, it's a hybrid that's rather wild. But the vigor of the roots is impressive, and that passes on the top part that produces the quality fruit. When it comes to difficult varieties like the heirlooms, the be much more difficult to grow. They tend to produce less per square meter. With grafted plant, the heirlooms can behave almost like a hybrid. In other words, they still are an heirloom. They still taste as delicious as they would otherwise, but they are much easier to grow. They last longer, more disease resistant, and the productivity is higher. Two is that I think the flavor is better. And that's because if a tomato vine is stressed, it can't quite handle the soil temperature, if it's too cool, if it can't get the nutrient uptake it needs, it affects the flavor. You have a less tasty tomato. But if you have a rootstock that's able to scrounge through the ground and get the micronutrients it needs and the water it needs and also the more steady level, then the plant's not only healthier, but the fruit tastes better. Advantages go on and on.
Well, that like is a has been a theme of my show all along, is that the better your soil, the healthier your soil, the better your fruit's going to be or your vegetable's going to be, whatever you're growing. And like especially Russ Medge talked about fruit trees, same thing. The healthier your tree, the less bugs and diseases you're going to have problems with, and the better your fruit and vegetables are going to come out. So, okay, well, do you want to tell us, I don't know, what do you want to talk about next?
Okay, well, I guess I should, for especially novice gardeners, when it comes to fertilizer, it is, you know, different plants require different amounts, and the old saying more is better is simply not true when it comes to fertilizer. More is deadly, so that you have to have the right amounts. Tomatoes are an example. If you have too much nitrogen, the plants tend to grow very vigorously, and the fruit tends to have less flavor. So if one maintains a balance in the nutrients for the tomatoes, then one has a slightly less vigorous plant, but the fruit production is not only higher, but tastier. Mm-hmm. What I mentioned with the grafted plants is if there's some problem with the fertilizing that isn't immediately apparent, then they help iron that out. One still needs to pay attention to soil health. Of course, organic nutrients and organic methods are better. They keep the soil more alive. They keep the soil healthier, which then transfers to a healthier root system, which then transfers to a healthier plant with a more nutritious fruit and more tasty. So that's one thing I wanted to emphasize, is that with the rootstocks, one cannot ignore fertilizing totally, but then also one doesn't want to use fertilizers indiscriminately, particularly the high nitrogen fertilizers with tomatoes. Those are not good. There's specific tomato formulas one can look at, organic and otherwise, and those are the ones one should use.
Okay. And is there like a certain time that you fertilize, like in the beginning or in the like after you, right after you transplant, or like when's the best time to fertilize your tomato plants?
Well, I if I was more ambitious, I'd fertilize in the fall. Again, I'm using organics. I use fish meal, bone meal, kelp meal, and then a mineral supplement that's an organically acceptable mineral supplement that has a high magnesium and sulfur and potassium level. And it comes under various names. Sulpomag is one of them, S-U-L-P-O-M-A-G.
But
those four are the basics I use. I like to get them into the soil and let them start feeding the soil. Again, it's sort of like one of the main premises of organic is feed the soil and the soil will feed your plants. And that's a better way than mainlining your plants with direct fertilization as chemical fertilizers tend to do. But this way one can get it in ahead of time. The soil starts working on it, starts breaking down the compounds. And as I said, I'm not disciplined enough usually to get it done in the fall. So perhaps in February, March, I get the fertilizers worked in, and then I can get the plants in, and it's already starting to act. One hybrid, one could say, between a natural and a chemical is liquid fish. It is organic. It is a natural, but in its liquid form, it does tend to feed the plant much more quickly. So that's great for when one is transplanting. It gives the little plants a boost right away. And while they're living off of that, then they can eventually get the roots out into the nice, naturally enriched soil that has the other ingredients that are now breaking down and the nutrients now becoming available.
Oh, cool. Okay. And so are you starting your plants in your... You start them in your house, right? Or are
I
you...
do. Uh-huh.
And you're... Did I say this part already? You're doing seeds or you're just grafting?
No, I do the seeds, even for the grafts. The reason is that it's true that one can carry tomato plants from year to year, but it is not a good idea. They tend to accumulate viruses. But when one starts with seed, and again, from a good seed source, then one has fresh plants that don't have the accumulated viruses. So I start seedlings of both the rootstock and the top graft. And then once they get to a proper size, I go ahead and do the grafting. I slice the top off the rootstock, and then I immediately attach the top part of the choice variety. Then I put them in a little chamber that I set up so that they need 100% humidity for a few days, because obviously the top has lost its roots. But while they're healing and grafting, they cannot be allowed to dry out. So I keep them misted and moist, and that way they are able to come together. But they do start out both as seeded seedlings that I'm in the process of seeding right now. Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I say, some people do like to see if they can keep a tomato alive for a while. And yeah, it's nice to experiment with that, but I don't really recommend it, especially for large scale. You're borrowing last year's trouble and importing it into this year. Not a good idea.
Okay. So let's see, what else can we talk about? So how did things go last year?
Oh, fantastic. It was overall a pretty good year as far as the, weather and so forth. It was, as usual, we have such a seesaw in western Montana. But having the plastic-covered hoop houses helps so much. In other words, there was a hailstorm that knocked out the tomatoes in certain parts of Missoula. People simply had no plants. So the tomatoes were demolished by the hail. And I was immune to that. I didn't really have hail in Arlie, but if I did get it, then the plastic makes sure that your delicate tomato plants don't get demolished. Also, if it's a surprise frosty night, then again, one can close it up and cover it up, put heat in if necessary, and yeah, it just makes gardening so much easier. I'm getting less and less enthused about gardening out in the open and getting more thrilled with gardening under a hoop house and enjoying the dirt, but still not having to worry about the weather so much.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I finally got him some cover crop, or I don't know what you call it, the crop covers, so he could build a hoop house. And so he just kind of started experimenting with it just basically this fall. But I think next spring he's going to go full on, and he's really going to, this is going to be our biggest year yet, I think, this spring coming up, where he's really going to put 100% of his energy into it. So we'll see what happens.
Well, here's what's amazing is that instead of having one big greenhouse, I have these smaller hoop houses. And one can get a big hoop house, but the way I grow and for my needs, I've gone with smaller multiple units. And that way I can start maybe one earlier and save on energy having to heat a whole large greenhouse or hoop house. And then expand as the season goes on. I can start another. But they're 12 feet by 25. That's the dimensions of my little hoop houses.
Okay.
And that allows to plant approximately 50 tomato plants. Usually I put in like 48 or thereabouts, but about 50 plants, let's say. And so last year, as I tallied the production, I was able to get a good 20 pounds of tomatoes per plant.
Wow.
So in this little by 25-foot area, one does the math, and it's pretty incredible. It's 1,000 pounds, in other words, half a ton of tomatoes from just a 12 foot by 25 area, good tomatoes. And so that's the way to go. It just enhances the production and ensures the production so tremendously that I encourage, one doesn't even have to go by 25. That's kind of small, but one can get anything to where you can just keep the worst of the weather off your plants, let the light in, maybe put a little heater out if you want, and expand your season and enhance your plant growth tremendously.
Nice. Richard Ruswell talked about that too. He's over on the East Coast in Vermont, and he said that that's the best way to grow the best tasting tomatoes, just like you did, same thing, and most effective, most efficient way to do it. He really talked about that a lot too. He wrote a book called The Organic Farmer's Business Handbook. I think it's the Organic Farmers Business Handbook. And he talks a lot about farmers. He coaches farmers who are, wanting to sell for a farmer's market and things. He did it for about 25 years and just retired recently. But now he's just kind of coaching people to help them be able to have a more effective business. So they're making a little more profit.
That's excellent. Yes.
And just being able to make a profit, be able to do it for a living, because if you're not making a good enough profit, you're not going to be able to keep going. So if you really...
Well, that's true. Yeah. I have to, like I said, I don't live off of this, but yet if I were to put a huge amount of resource into it and get very little back, eventually it becomes too expensive a hobby. So I do want to figure out what kind of wage I want for myself. And I've modified things and analyzed things and changed things to the point where I can pull off actually making enough money to keep me going, to keep purchasing newer innovations as they come along, to keep experimenting, but also to provide a much needed, nutritious and wonderful crop for the public. I also experiment extensively with varieties so that I can try to get the best to people who come to my table.
Oh, that's so true. We definitely need more nutritious food in our planet that's accessible to everyone. So what else do you want to tell us about? Like, do you want to tell us, is there something you're excited that you're going to do differently next year that you've never tried before? Like, what's your new experiment you're coming up with?
Well, as far as total entire procedure, nothing particularly. The other fellow for whom I grow most of the plants, he and I have been trading off on experiments. Last year, between him and me, we planted approximately 52 different tomato varieties.
Oh, my goodness.
We still had our main crops. In other words, the ones that have done well for us in the past, those were most of the plants. But we would grow anywhere from 1 to 2 to 4 experimental plants. And so I am excited about one. I went to Spain the year before. I actually try to get to Europe at least every fall if I can, October, November. And then I scrounge to see what kind of things are growing in the markets. Northern Europe, it's generally past. The seasons are like here. They start closing down. But in Spain, they're still going full bore with locally grown produce. The climate permits that. And so I'm always intrigued with what are they growing, what kind of tomatoes, how do they taste? And each city that I was spending much time in, Valencia and Barcelona, I made sure I got an apartment that was just like a block right from their big fresh markets. So Mercat Central in Valencia and La Boqueria in Barcelona. I went and looked to see what were they growing, what are they bringing. And so last year I... had brought back a tomato from the central market in Valencia. And this family said, well, we've been growing this for years. It's our own seed. It's our own variety. So they kindly gave me a tomato. I left it with a friend in Spain who did the extraction of the seeds. Tomatoes have to be allowed to ferment a little bit before the seed becomes viable. And then the seed has to be extracted, then washed, and then cleaned before it's legal to ship it anywhere. And I was able to grow an absolutely beautiful Valenciano tomato that was huge and delicious. It wasn't the only one. I grew a number of others from both seeds and from various sources. Well, this year, this summer, I grew another type called Tres Cantos. And this Tres Cantos tomato absolutely blew me away. I had just one plant. That's all the space I had was just for one plant. And it's now going to be my main vine, large vine tomato for next year. The flavor is so outstanding and has done so well in Arley that I'm absolutely thrilled. So I hope to share with everybody who comes to my table this incredibly good Spanish tomato. I was actually mixed this tomato with several others when they first started ripening, and I was eating through them and said, oh, this is good. This is good. I was like, wow, what's this? And so I had to wait for everything to ripen and then try them individually till I could focus on the vine that was producing this extraordinary tomato. So now I know what it is, and went back to Valencia, and they had no seed. So I was kind of downhearted about that. Then I went to Barcelona, and in front of my apartment was this little pedestrian strip with little booths and little shops and everything. And I happened to see one in front of me that had vegetable seeds. So I went there, and wouldn't you know, that the variety, the Tres Cantos variety.
Oh,
and
cool.
I just like bought them out. I bought every packet he had, which will keep me in Tres Cantos for several years. The other thing was that Tres Cantos is not a hybrid. I can save the seed, and that's mm-hmm. what eventually I'll do. I'll start to bring a large amount of plants and start focusing on the ones that seem to do the best, that have the best fruit. And then I start developing my own version of Tres Cantos.
Nice. How exciting. I finally got to go to Europe this year for the first time in my life. I went to Paris last February. I was going to go to Spain, right near Barcelona, too, but I never made it there. But what an exciting trip and story you have. So I guess, I don't know, like, what made you go to Spain and, like, go to Valencia and be like, how do you know where to stay there and like get an apartment? And I lucked out because I got like my airplane and my apartment on Expedia, and it was like practically one deal. Like, how?
Those can be good. Yes, but I have had contacts going way back several decades to Spain, and what I do is I start shopping for my ticket months ahead of time. I'm also a bit of an opera buff, so I start looking at what's playing in the opera houses in Europe.
Really?
I also have these various friends that I want to see, you know, again and so forth. So it's the logistics are a little bit daunting, but I managed to pull it off. They're pretty intense visits. But then also I'm looking at the markets. And if I could go earlier, then definitely I think that France and England would have some interesting varieties I'd like to try. But because I'm so busy with my own market, I barely get away as early as I do. I can't really go later because especially if I want to go to England and France, the weather deteriorates in November, much like it does here. Mm-hmm. Spain is always pretty nice, but this way I have this very narrow window, basically mid-October to mid-November, and that's when I go. And I prepare ahead of time. I look at various lodging sites and look at the customer reviews and also the little maps to see just where these places are. So I am just the place in Barcelona, excuse me, in Valencia, I have used it twice now, and I do my best to be the best kind of lodger possible. So the woman has actually given me better yet fares just because she's so happy to have me come back, and she knows that I leave it immaculate.
Oh, nice.
And Barcelona, now I have a very happy welcome to come back. Paris, too. It's just that the ways to work this, and these people work very hard to provide these apartments, and when you treat them right, they're extremely grateful, and you always have a welcome to go back, and that's a real treasure when traveling, is to always have a little home away from home you can always go back to.
Totally. I have to say, the place I stayed, they made me feel like that. It was really nice. I really lucked out because I was really nervous. I had never been, I knew nothing. I'm like, is this in a good area? Is it a bad area? Where am I going to be? I know, you know, and I've always been scared to go to like a country where I don't speak the language. But in Paris, it was pretty easy. Almost everybody spoke English. The guys at my apartment were awesome, and they helped me get everywhere. They were funny, though. They laughed at me because they're like, we've never met anybody who takes the bus as much. Like, they're like, take the subway. And I'm like, well, I'm not in a hurry to get there. Like, the whole part, half of my journey is just like watching and looking at the streets. And just like, I didn't have a lot of money for sure. So to me, it was just like checking out. So I never, ever did make it on the metro. I just rode the bus all over. But
well,
it was
the metro
fun.
Does have that disadvantage. All you see is black. You're going from station to station. I did take the metro because of the speed and I was familiar with it. But buses are the way to go to see the city. And one little tourist advice, too, is that places like Madrid, London, Paris, they have the tourist buses that do a certain route. And you can get on, get off, get on, get off all throughout. If you see something interesting, oh, I wanted to go see this, you can hop off. And then later on, the bus shows up and you can hop back on. So those are highly recommended for someone who's perhaps not familiar with the city that wants to see everything. Those are very, very good options.
Yeah, I just took the regular bus, but you could only do one transfer, and then after 2 hours, you had to buy a new ticket. But I just
Right,
rode the
yeah.
regular bus. But I think I probably rode about all of them by the time I was done. And I've been everywhere.
Yep,
And I would
lots
like
to
ride to
see.
the one night I kind of almost got myself in trouble because I like rode the guy. He's like, "No, you want to go the other way?" And I was like, "Well, I'll just ride to the end of the line and then ride back." But it was at night, and like I was lucky that it was still going back because it could have like I could have got stuck at the end of the line in the wrong direction, and I didn't. That was the biggest thing. Like I
Yes.
could figure out how to say like the two things I could figure out how to say, how do I get there, and how much does it cost? But I couldn't understand anything they were telling me. They would answer,
I
and they talk
know,
so
it's
fast, and I'd be
true.
like, "Huh? Oh, what
Yes.
now?" So,
Well, but
yeah.
they're pretty good at people who are terrified, and they are very helpful. I've never encountered anybody being mean or rude to me,
Nope.
really anywhere.
Cool.
And so, in all these years, it's just that if you find someone, if that were to happen, I think, I've had bad days too. I've been less than polite, so just chalk it up to that. When 99% are nice, that's what you go with.
I agree. Well, cool. So tomatoes from Spain.
Yes.
So, well, do you want to tell us about something that didn't work so well this season that didn't go quite the way you thought it was gonna?
Oh, let's see. Eggplants. I love eggplants, and they're the most beautiful plant in the garden, in my opinion. There's just something about
Those
the
purple
beauty of eggplants.
flowers.
Oh, the fruit and the plants and the big purple flowers. They're just a beautiful plant, but I have noticed over the years that I do have a chronic issue with spider mites. They're just endemic here. They're not anything much I can do to avoid. So I tried growing eggplants under cover, as I do the tomatoes, and it was a flaming disaster. I could not keep the spider mites at bay. I used soap sprays, and then after I did that, then I went ahead and ordered predatory mites, which can be quite effective. But somehow eggplants are such mite candy that even the predatory mites could not keep the big plant munching mites at bay. So it was something I learned. I simply, if I'm going to grow eggplant, I do have to grow it out in the open garden. Start the plants early, cover them on the chilly nights. Do that because otherwise, if there's any kind of cover for a prolonged time, the spider mites just go nuts, and I can't grow them. I had seen a bit of an effect of that. I tried to winter them over in my house, and the spider mites would just totally dominate no matter what I did. So that's one thing I learned. I found that tomatoes and peppers, though, do very well. You might see some spider mite damage if you look hard, but somehow they're just not naturally the choice food for spider mites, but eggplants really are.
Okay, good to know. I want to say Mike has tried some kind of like cinnamon extract spray.
Yes. Oh, that's
I don't
pretty fragrant.
know. Am
Yeah,
I thinking of the right
it's
thing?
yeah, you are. It's got a real strong and not unpleasant odor. It's not the greatest, but it's quite effective for a lot of things. But I tried it. I tried different variations. I tried the oil sprays. It's interesting that when it comes to both spider mites and aphids, that there isn't really a, what would you say, a superior chemical advantage. Even the commercial growers will use what we'd call organic methods. In other words, the soap sprays, they'll do the repellents just because they are that effective. And when it comes to ornamentals, there is kind of a scary anti-mite chemical pesticide, but you mix it in the soil, the plant takes it up, and the whole plant becomes toxic. Well, obviously, that does not work for edibles. And then you have to be careful if you have ornamental and the leaves drop and your cat eats it, your cat could get sick. So it's not an option. In other words, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Totally by yourself, and it's just an ornamental, and you don't have any pets. But in the garden, utterly that one could use that method. Otherwise, most of the time it works. I've had other people in this area who grow eggplants easily under plastic without a big spider mite problem. So it's just one little area, and for me, this has been going on for years. I don't have, I don't understand it, but I just have to live with it.
Interesting. Well, good to know.
Yeah.
Well, anything else you want to talk about today? We've talked about a lot and you've shared tons of golden seeds. I know people are going to be excited to hear this again and hear your voice. And yeah. I'm just going to put a replay up right before that of our last interview. So that'll be that I'm posting today. Like it, I was right in the middle of posting it when I called you.
Okay.
So then, and then I'll try to get this one up on Monday. And we're talking on Saturday, December 3rd, if listeners are curious. So anything else you want to share with the audience? Anything new that you've learned or different or?
Well, let's see. I do get questions from people who are starting out and I just say, be patient. You know, to grow things is such a miracle that, you know, don't ever look at disasters as a commandment from God to stop. Instead, look at them as a wonderful learning experience. And even if it's been heartbreaking, one does learn in one different ways, and then when success comes along, finally, it's even sweeter.
Cool. I love that advice. And I think that crosses into all parts of our lives, not just gardening.
It does. It does, yes.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us today, David.
My pleasure.
And, maybe some people will come to Montana and see you at the farmer's market this summer.
That would be a delight, yes. There's all sorts of postings for both Missoula markets. There's actually, well, let me correct that. There are three Missoula markets on Saturday mornings in the downtown. Makes it downtown Missoula just a particularly wonderful and special place. And give oneself time to visit all three. They're all three interesting and all three unique in their own way.
Nice. All right. Well, you have a good day and I'll let you know when this is live. All right.
All
thanks,
right.
David.
I appreciate that.
Did you know that you could support the Organic Gardener podcast without doing anything differently? If you're going to buy something on Amazon.com, since I'm an Amazon affiliate, if you go to Amazon through a link on my page, which every book that is listed on my website is linked to Amazon.com, you don't have to buy that book, but anything you buy that day from Amazon will give me a very, very small commission. But I got to tell you, it would sure help pay for, you know, just some of the basics it costs to keep the podcast up there. So if you like what you hear and you did want to give me just a little bit of support, that would be a great way for you to do it. If you're already going to Amazon to purchase something, like I said, all the books are linked up to because I am an Amazon affiliate. And so just if you didn't know anything, you don't have to buy that specific book, but just if you go to Amazon through my website, they do still give me a commission. So thanks for your support. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening and remember to grow.